The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening. This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Early this morning, the three American hostages freed by North Korea landed safely in the United States.
Yeah, that's great news.
Welcome home.
You gotta give it up. When good things happen, you gotta give it up. The president was there to meet the freed men, along with Melania, who is hoping to be freed next. It's too long. Trump made some brief remarks, pretty simple. All he had to do was not thank the murderous dictator who had imprisoned these men in a windowless black hole.
Right.
I want to thank Kim Jong-un, who really was excellent to these three incredible people.
What?
No, he wasn't.
No, he wasn't.
He wasn't excellent to them. And you know the hint that he wasn't? They look happy to be with you. Okay? That's how low the bar is.
Yep.
You don't negotiate the release of people from an excellent situation. Don't worry, we're sending in SEAL Team 6 to extract you from that all-inclusive beach vacation. And Trump was not done praising these hostages' kidnapper right in front of them, this time because Kim let them go before his meeting with Mike Pompeo.
And it was nice in letting them go before the meeting. I mean, frankly, we didn't think this was going to happen, and it did.
Coincidentally, that's also what it says beneath Trump's official portrait. No, I did not know.
We didn't know.
Nope.
Couldn't know.
They're eventually going to carve his head on Mount Oopsie-daisy. Of course, no Trump accomplishment would be complete without a little bragging about ratings.
I want to thank you all. It's very early in the morning. I think you probably broke the all-time in history television rating for 3 o'clock in the morning, that I would say.
Yes, that is how history judges all presidential accomplishments. Did it do better than an infomercial for Slap Chop? Some are attributing this diplomatic victory to Trump's plan to out-crazy North Korea. Thanks for releasing the hostages, Kim. Now I'm sending them back. Didn't see that coming. All right? I've been eating paint chips. Trump is fond of saying that every other U.S. president was predictable, which let their adversaries run rings around them. Yeah, Obama was so predictable when he killed Osama bin Laden instead of surprising the world by thanking him.
Right. Right. Oh, yeah, a little bit of humor to get us started on a Friday. Welcome to it. I am Nicole Sandler, coming to you live at NicoleSandler.com and through the magic of digital audio on the Progressive Voices Network, Tuesday through Friday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 Pacific. Oh, welcome to it. I'm so glad this week is over. This week felt like a month, but it seems like every week in the Trump era feels like a month. Just moments before we came on the air, Trump spoke in the Rose Garden, ostensibly to lay out a plan to lower prescription drug prices. I only caught a little bit of it because I was busy preparing for the show. And it seems that the things that he promised during the campaign are nowhere to be found in his policy. Shocker. Right? Zeke Emanuel, you know, he is the brother of Rahm Emanuel and Ari Emanuel, who was an advisor to the Obama administration. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He was on CNN after hearing what Trump had to say. And, well, he had the same takeaway pretty much that I did.
First of all, nothing the president has said is going to lower prices for those people who have private insurance, which is half of the American population mm-hmm. who gets their insurance through their employer. Absolutely nothing he suggested is going to really affect them. So they're left out in the cold. Second, the president was advised. I actually, when I talked to him several times, suggested this should be his leading issue. It's a bipartisan issue. Everyone wants drug prices down. But he, as you point out, we're now over 480 days into his administration, finally coming around to actually doing something or making an announcement about this. And there's no, again, I can't tell you how thin this plan is. It just doesn't seem to be very substantial. And I think the major reason is if you're going to bring drug prices down, you actually have to confront the drug industry and force them. Literally, every country in the world regulates drug prices, forces them to come down. And this president seemed to want to do that on the campaign trail, had that intuition, but as was mentioned, his Republican colleagues don't like that idea. So you have to take on the drug companies, and he opted, his rhetoric is he's taking them on, but the facts are he's not taking them on. You have to do something about the patents, the FDA marketing exclusivity, or set a maximum price for drugs, none of which is he willing to do.
None of which does he seem to be willing to do. And there's the operative phrase there. So more of the same, a lot of empty, you know, noise with no substance behind it. So if you were thinking your drug prices are going to go down because Trump promised it, then you're a sucker. Sucker. Oy. Well, it is Friday. Maybe you're taking a movie this weekend. There's actually a fascinating movie that opened in, I think, New York and Los Angeles last Friday. It opens today in Miami and some other cities, and it's rolling out around the country. And it is a documentary on, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Today we're going to be talking a bit about justice. In the second half hour, my old friend Zach Roberts will join us. Now, if you were listening around the summertime, around the time of the Charlottesville mess, you heard Zach Roberts. He's a photojournalist. He works with Greg Palast, among other people. And he happened to be in Charlottesville. He happened to be in the parking garage when a young man named, what was his name? DeAndre Harris was beaten mercilessly by a bunch of these white supremacists who were there for this white power rally. Zach Roberts had a gun pulled on him. You may remember a lot around that incident. Well, one of the people who beat DeAndre Harris was found guilty this week, and others are going to be going to trial, and others still have not been identified. Zach Roberts will join us again today to talk about that, the progress they've made on it, where they are on finding these other people, and his trip to Dallas last weekend for the NRA convention as well. He'll join us. So we'll talk about justice, but we're going to start the show today by talking about a different kind of justice, the Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. This new movie, this new documentary is called RBG for obviously, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. It is out in movie theaters now. And talk about an inspiration. Let's get right to it. Joining me on the line right now are Betsy West and Julie Cohn, the directors and producers of RBG, a new documentary exploring the exceptional life and career of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Now, I got to ask you, a film about an 85-year-old Supreme Court justice, not a very likely commercial topic for a major motion picture. What was it about Ruth Bader Ginsburg that inspired you guys to make this film?
Well, Nicole, RBG is kind of a millennial rock star, believe it or not. She is very popular with a whole group of people who have her picture on their T-shirts, and they even put her face on tattoos, really because of her words as a Supreme Court justice, writing very stinging dissents, speaking truth to power. But sort of beyond that, she has an amazing personal story of the accomplishments to help women legally in the 1970s, what she did, and also a very wonderful feminist romance that we knew that her fans and others would be interested in.
Right. There's a lot, obviously, as a Supreme Court justice, we don't know a whole lot about her other than she sparked something in the American public, something caught on that inspired people. But her background is pretty amazing. First of all, she was a gorgeous young woman. I think a lot of people don't realize that until we see these pictures of this stunning young Ruth Bader. Who was she was among the first class to admit women in Harvard, wasn't she?
That's right. As you'll see in our film, there's unbelievable home movies of her and her beloved husband Marty when they were a young couple, glamorous and gorgeous, both of them. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was one of nine women in a class of 500 at Harvard Law School when she entered in the late 1950s. The dean of the law school brought those nine women together, served them a nice dinner, and then asked them to answer the question one by one, why are you taking the place of that could be held by a man? This was an era when women just weren't welcome in the top echelons of power in the U.S., certainly including law school and at law firms. When she graduated from law school, again, top near the top of her tied for first in her classes at Columbia, she had transferred, couldn't get a job at a New York City law firm because hiring women just kind of wasn't a thing back then. People don't realize that now. We sort of forget as a few decades have passed all the changes that have happened. And the point that our film is trying to make is that a lot of those changes are because of the work that Ruth Bader Ginsburg did herself.
Right. She was a pioneer in gender equality, right?
Yeah. There were really thousands of laws kind of baked into our system that discriminated against women. I mean, women could be fired if they got pregnant. They had to get the permission of their husband to get credit or a mortgage. You know, and husbands were never, ever charged with raping their wives. Women were second-class citizens. And this was just kind of accepted. Nobody questioned it. Until Ruth Bader Ginsburg came along, she started a project in which she strategically took a series of cases before the Supreme Court and argued before nine male justices, this is not fair. And she did it in a very strategic, logical way and eventually made her point and changed the world for American women.
It is pretty remarkable. Both before she joined the court and after, she had a huge impact on American life as we know it. What do you see as her major accomplishments before she joined the Supreme Court?
Yeah, we think her major accomplishment before she joined the court, and you'll really see the substance of this and the power of it in our film, is the six cases that she brought to the court as a lawyer where she argued that under the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and the Equal Protection Clause, that should apply to men and women. Previously, it had been applied for racial equality, and her point was it should apply to gender equality. When if there's a law that discriminates against women or that discriminates against men, for that matter, and there were some of those, it should be deemed unconstitutional, she argued, because we all should have equal rights under the law.
That's great. And then, and since she's been on the court, she's taken on the role of the great dissenter. She's written a whole bunch of dissents. What do you think she's most proud of?
Well, I think Justice Ginsburg did not start out as the great dissenter. Mm-hmm. She really was considered to be a moderate justice, and she very much wants to convince other justices to come over to her point of view. In some way, she has a kind of restrained style that matches her seemingly restrained personality. But as the court moved to the right in the 1980s with appointments made by President Bush, she found herself more often writing dissenting opinions. As she says, I'd rather be writing for the majority, but if I have to, I will write in dissent. And she's written very clear and stinging objections to some of the court's opinions, like in Shelby County, where the court ruled that we no longer needed oversight in certain states that had discriminated against African Americans in voting. The court ruled that was no longer necessary. She wrote a great dissent saying that this argument is like taking down your umbrella in a rainstorm just because you're not getting wet. People understood that language, and they took it up, and she is certainly now known for these words.
Betsy West and Julie Cohn are with us. They're the directors and producers of RGB, a new documentary just opened this weekend, now opening around the country in major theaters. What made you guys say, you know, hey, let's make a movie about Ruth Bader Ginsburg?
Well, you know, I think part of it was just noticing how much attention she was getting. I mean, it's not every Supreme Court justice that has their pictures up on the internet kind of superimposed mm-hmm. with Wonder Woman or with a crown on their head and sayings like can't spell truth without Ruth. Betsy and I had each interviewed her previously for other projects, and we knew the amazing life story that was behind all this, and we just wanted, like, you know, she's got all these fans worshiping her. Let's help them kind of understand what it's all about. Some people know the full story, but a lot of people don't, and there's so much more to her life. You know, she and her beloved husband, Marty, met each other at Cornell in the 1950s. As you mentioned, RBG was a beautiful young woman. She had her pick of men because it was a 4-to-1 ratio of males to females. She said Marty was the first guy who cared that she had a brain. And boy, did he care. He throughout their whole lives together, he pushed for her to succeed. He bragged that she was going to make the law review, which she did. And then he really did everything he could to lobby to help her get a seat as a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court.
You know, it's an amazing marriage ahead of its time. And we just love the story of Marty and Ruth and how devoted they were to each other, how they helped each other. They weren't threatened by each other. They were just so proud, and they had a wonderful relationship.
It sounds like they did. She was pretty accessible to you, it seems. She sat for a lot of interviews, as did other people. How into this project was she?
Well, you know, we try to make it look that she was super accessible, but the fact is she's a very busy woman mm-hmm. and, you know, is with a busy calendar at the court, and she also travels around the country speaking to organizations. We followed her to many of those events, which were fascinating, and eventually we did get to spend some time with her, more personal time at home, her with her granddaughter. Amazing, half an hour that we spent in her gym doing the legendary workout, in which she actually does do the push-ups and weightlifting and planks, side planks. So, you know, we kind of moved in and then did do an extensive interview with her. But I have to say, it was more us just trying to gather all of this material. She didn't see the film until it was in the Sundance Film Festival.
Oh, wow. And what was her verdict?
Well, when Justice Ginsburg showed up at Sundance, she was treated like more of a movie star than the actual movie stars that were there.
Wow.
So that was really fun. Everywhere she walked in the snowy streets of Park City, there were, like, you know, crowds running around trying to get a selfie with her on their cell phones, you know, paparazzi, all that kind of attention that we usually associate with pop culture celebrities. She saw the film at its world premiere. Betsy and I were right across the aisle from her, basically staring at her face through the whole time to see how she would react. She laughed, she cried, she commented that she really enjoyed the music. We actually have some hip-hop music in our film, but we think she was referring to the opera that
right.
we use as well, because she's a big opera fan. Afterwards, she came down when someone asked what she thought of it and said that she had enjoyed the film greatly, and it was certainly pretty magical moment for us and for the crowd that was there.
You point out in the film that she had a great sense of humor, has a great sense of humor. Her husband, Marty, was the one who was actually the funny guy. And you showed a scene where you showed her the Kate McKinnon impression of her on Saturday Night Live, which she seemed to really enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, Justice Ginsburg is in some ways a very quiet and sometimes shy person, as she refers to herself as, I tend to be rather sober. However, she has a very sly wit, which you'll see in the film. There's a wonderful scene of her with Justice Scalia in which they're going back and forth, and she gets the better of him. And certainly she has a sense of humor about herself, so that when we showed her the clip of Kate McKinnon, we don't think she'd seen it before because she doesn't watch television. We were in the Supreme Court. We pushed the play button. We didn't know what her reaction would be. She said, oh, is that Saturday Night Live? And then she just burst out laughing. I mean, it was quite wonderful to see her reaction.
What did you learn in making this film that surprised you the most?
I think the most surprising piece of information people won't expect about Justice Ginsburg is what an adventurous spirit she has. We're particularly fond of a picture of her riding an elephant, which mm-hmm. is not a particularly old picture. Relatively recently, on a trip to India, she was atop an elephant, which is fun to see. She also enjoys parasailing. She went parasailing in France. Unfortunately, we were unable to find an image of that, so we're putting out the word that if anyone has footage of Justice Ginsburg parasailing, please let us know.
That would be something to see. She is 85 years old. There are many of us in this age of Trump who are very nervous that she may not have the fortitude to last on the court throughout his entire term. I know you brought up the idea that some were asking her to retire before Obama left office in the case that something untoward like this happened. But she's in it for the long haul, right?
That's what she says. Whenever people ask her, and she is asked about this frequently, she says that she'll do the job as long as she can do it full steam. For Justice Ginsburg, full steam is pretty intense. She works very hard. She stays up late until the night. She has to catch up on her sleep on the weekends. I mean, we witnessed this, going to her apartment in the afternoon on a weekend, and, you know, she first cup of coffee in the early afternoon. But she keeps up a very demanding schedule and certainly has given every indication that she's going to stick around. She's named her clerks for not just next year, but for the year after. And she's in that gym working out and keeping herself in shape.
Good. Does she ever comment on Trump? Did she weigh in on his presidency at all?
She did not weigh in with that with us. As you know, she had gotten into some trouble for making some remarks while he was a candidate for president. Mm-hmm. Since then, she has chosen to remain, as she would say, judiciously silent. She'll let herself speak through the dissents that she writes for the court.
The movie is RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Betsy West and Julie Cohen, the directors and producers. Thank you so much. It was a fascinating film, flew by, and for a woman who is already so likable, I think she just reinforces those notions. It's a great film. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Nicole. Bye-bye.
So there is you go, the producers and directors of the film RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, playing now in a theater near you, as they say. It's a major, you know, it's a documentary, but it's in a theatrical release, I believe opening today in Miami and other cities around the nation. I highly recommend it. And, you know, it's a good Mother's Day film, so go take your mom. Betsy West and Julie Cohn, thanks to them for joining us today. All right, we've got Zach Roberts coming up in a little bit to continue our justice theme for today, but let's wait no longer and get into what's news.
I read the news today, oh boy. It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Well, the Senate count to confirm Gina Haspel to lead the CIA following her Wednesday hearing is underway, and it's close. Haspel needs support from 50 senators, and Republicans have only a slim 51-49 majority. Republicans John McCain and Rand Paul have already announced their opposition, but Democrat Joe Manchin has announced his support. Stay tuned. Things turned ugly on Thursday, first on the Fox Business Network, when a guy named Thomas McInerney, a military analyst, said that torture worked on Senator John McCain while defending the U.S. so-called enhanced interrogation program. He said this.
Well, she can't use it anymore because we've determined the Congress that it's not legal. The fact is John McCain, it worked on John. That's why they call him Songbird John.
Aye.
The fact is you, those methods can work, and they're effective, as former Vice President Cheney said. And if we have to use them to save a million American lives, we will do whatever we have to.
John McCain spent 5 years as a prisoner of war in Vietnam, where he was brutally tortured and left with permanent injuries. That Fox host, Charles Payne, let the offensive comment go unchecked until later yesterday afternoon, when he took to both Twitter and the airwaves to apologize.
This morning, on a show that I was hosting, Lieutenant General Thomas McInerney made a false and derogatory statement about Senator John McCain's actions when he was a prisoner of war. Regrettably, I did not hear the comments at the time. I was receiving instructions in my ear at that moment from producers. If I heard what he said the right way, I would have pushed back. I didn't. I blew it. As a proud military veteran and a son of a Vietnam vet, I hold all those who served in the highest esteem. I, in fact, have very high respect for Senator McCain's lifetime of service and sacrifice to this nation. Those reprehensible comments do not reflect how I feel or how this network feels about Senator McCain.
An apology. What a concept. One you'll never get from the White House. Things got nasty there as well, as The Hill reported that as the White House Communications Department met to strategize over McCain's opposition to Haspel's confirmation, Special Assistant Kelly Sadler, that's Sadler, not Sandler, told her colleagues, it doesn't matter. He's dying anyway.
We've been able to confirm a story that came out in The Hill earlier this afternoon that Kelly Sadler, who is an assistant to the president, works at the White House with communications with surrogates, apparently said at a meeting this morning among other communications staffers in reference to Senator John McCain's opposition to Gina Haspel's nomination to run the CIA. It doesn't matter, according to a White House official. Kelly Sadler said, quote, it doesn't matter because John McCain is dying anyway. According to an official who confirmed this to us, this was thought to be a joke that was told by Kelly Sadler in the room to other White House staffers. But according to this White House official, the joke, quote, fell flat. Now, we should point out the White House has released a statement to try to clean up this mess. And this is from a White House official. There's no White House spokesperson putting their name on the statement. It says, we respect Senator McCain's service to our nation, and he and our family are in our prayers during this difficult time. Of course, Senator McCain is recovering and dealing with cancer.
Cindy McCain, the senator's wife, tweeted in response, at Kelly Sadler 45, in case you wanted her Twitter handle. May I remind you, my husband has a family, 7 children and 5 grandchildren. Sadler reportedly called McCain's daughter, Megan McCain, to apologize. That reportedly did not go well. But there's been no public apology, and Sadler inexplicably still has a job at the White House. In a somewhat related but unwelcome story, former Vice President Dick Cheney also weighed in, saying that so-called enhanced interrogation programs should continue. More trouble in Trump's cabinet as Kirstjen Nielsen, the Secretary of Homeland Security, almost tendered her resignation on Wednesday.
The New York Times reports Kirstjen Nielsen, the Homeland Security Secretary, told colleagues she was close to resigning after President Trump berated her on Wednesday in front of the entire cabinet for what he said was her failure to adequately secure the nation's borders. According to several current and former officials familiar with the episode, the Times goes on to report Nielsen drafted a resignation letter but has not submitted it. And, quote, Ms. Nielsen viewed the president's rant as directed mostly at her, and she told associates after the meeting that she should not continue in the job if he did not view her as effective. One person close to Ms. Nielsen said she is miserable in her job. After the Time story was published, the Homeland Security Secretary said in a statement she's not leaving her post and will continue to implement the president's security-focused agenda.
Now, according to the New York Times' Maggie Haberman, Trump's dispute with Nielsen isn't just about policy, but part of a broader paranoid delusion about where her loyalties truly lie. This man is demented. Haberman tweeted, quote, "Someone, as sources have put it, has gotten it in his head that she is a Bush family plant," end quote. According to the New York Times report, Trump has been angry that Nielsen has been resisting his direction that parents be separated from their children when families cross illegally into the United States. And the guy who was supposed to be, the adult in the room, John Kelly, did an interview with NPR where he apparently doubled down on Trump's feeling that parents should be separated from their kids. It's sickening. The Michael Cohen saga continues heating up. Phone giant AT&T reportedly paid Trump's personal attorney $600,000 for information, including advice on a pending $85 billion merger with Time Warner. Yesterday, Stormy Daniels' lawyer, Michael Avenatti, released a suspicious email from Cohen to Daniels' previous attorney, Keith Davidson, and warned Cohen that he still has more emails and text messages still to come.
This email is very, very disturbing for the following reasons. First of all, it's less than 48 hours after the FBI raided Michael Cohen's home, his office, and his hotel room. Michael Cohen reaches out to my client's former attorney, Keith Davidson. He notes that he doesn't have his cell phone, and I can confirm that that's because the FBI had taken it in the raid. And he is communicating with Mr. Davidson, but they don't have any legal cases at that time together. They don't have any reason to be communicating. They're clearly not making dinner reservations. And Michael Cohen inquires as to how they should communicate. And then he also references this Anthony as it relates to some interview that evidently Keith Davidson and Michael Cohen were in the process of trying to get set up. So, look, this is very disturbing. It appears that Michael Cohen, even after the FBI raid, was tampering potentially with the story, potentially interfering with witness testimony or trying to shape it, which may constitute obstruction of justice. Michael Cohen had no business communicating with my client's former attorney after the representation ended, let alone after the FBI raided his residence. We haven't even scratched the surface with this email today and the information that we released earlier in the week. We've got all kinds of information. We've got emails, we've got text messages, we've got other financial information, and people better be very careful in the representations that they make. And I'm speaking to you, Michael Cohen, and your counsel, Mr. Ryan, and others. You better be really careful in the representations you make in court filings and to the American people, because we're going to prove you wrong if the need be, period.
Hashtag basta. That's how Michael Avenatti ends all his tweets. Hashtag basta, which I believe in Spanish means enough. Enough. And that's a little bit of what's news for now. There's so much going on that it's impossible to cover it all. So we do our best to scratch the surface for you every day. All right. I told you we're going to deal with justice today. We dealt with Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Now on to a different kind of justice. And there's been some slight justice meted out, and hopefully more to come. To talk about that, we bring in our next guest. Zach D. Roberts is a photojournalist who works with Greg Palast. He's a co-producer of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. And his work can be seen at nationofchange.org. Now, Zach and I spoke shortly after the Charlottesville rally this summer, as Zach found himself right in the middle of the beating of a man named DeAndre Harris, and he captured it on film. Hey, Zach, you there?
Yep, I'm here. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing?
Okay. I don't think there's enough news happening right now.
You know.
I think that it's really just been a slow news week. So, yeah.
It's a week that feels like a month, and a month that feels like 3 years.
Welcome to the Trump administration.
It's stress-inducing. I don't know how, I don't know how people do it. I have a hard time keeping up with it, and it gives me it keeps me awake at night. It's just, it's, yeah.
Yeah, I know the feeling.
Yes. So I want to talk about your trip to Dallas for the NRA convention. We'll get to that in a few minutes. But first, I do want to bring us up to date on the latest out of this Charlottesville mess. Just to refresh people's memories, in case they weren't with us back in August, you were in Charlottesville for the rally. I forget what they called it. It was some
Unite the Right.
Unite the Right rally, yeah. People knew it was going to be ugly, that these white supremacists were going to be out in force, trying to protect their monuments of white superiority. But you wrote at nationofchange.org in a piece that I will post on my blog today, NicoleSandler.com, along with the show, that you didn't wear a helmet or your vest or did you not think that there was danger involved here?
Well, I mean, there's always a chance for danger. I mean, I've been arrested and beaten up by cops, beaten up by so-called Antifa. You know, there's been, you never know what's going to happen. I kind of assumed that, because the night before was the Tiki Torch rally. Mm-hmm. That was supposedly unplanned, and, you know, relatively unplanned at least, you know, not in the way that they got permits or anything like that. It just kind of happened. And I kind of thought that since that got so much media attention and so much thing, that the police and that everybody would just be kind of not necessarily on their best behavior. I mean, you're talking about white supremacists here and Nazis and KKK
right.
members.
Right.
I mean, this is literally like just a group of deplorables, as a certain candidate might have said.
Mm-hmm.
But I never thought, I didn't think it was going to turn into the complete clusterfuck that it did. and that had so much to do with the fact that the police, I know that there wasn't an official stand down order that was issued, but the fact that the police made the decision, it seemed, to just not do anything, and not just not do anything, but to push members of the white supremacists into the counter protesters, you know, Antifa and just local clergy. You know, I mean, not even like your crazy, you know, God, I'm trying to think of, you know, Soros funded Antifa with clubs and bats and everything
right.
like that, like, you know, the machinations of some right wing, you know, Alex Jones or something. But just like they mushed them together, the press was kind of in the middle of that, and shockingly, it turned into what we now know happened, you know, and that's what happens. I mean, the police, I think, should be on trial, honestly, right now for a lot of what happened there. And there is some, you know, rumblings about, you know, lawsuits and things like that. But, you know, it wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for that. I think there would have been the small skirmishes and things like that there always is. But they specifically drove them, the two opposing groups together, and really kind of caused everything that happened that day.
Now you found yourself in a parking garage right next door to the police station, and where DeAndre Harris was beaten, and there you were with your cameras, because that's what you're there to do. You're a photojournalist. So how did you find yourself there at that time? Was it just a coincidence?
Yeah, it was just a coincidence. I mean, I was walking along following a group of the, I think it was mostly the League of the South, which is a neo-Confederate group, that, you know, AKA white supremacist, I mean,
mm-hmm.
group that, was marching along, who had helmets, who had, you know, masks, who had shields and batons and kind of all different types of, you know, quote unquote, as they would call it, self-defense weapons. And they're marching along, and I just happened to see a group of local Charlottesville residents, or at least I would discover that they were local, at least that they were yelling, "Get out of our town," so I assumed right off the bat that they were local. That included DeAndre Harris and his friends, so I followed along, a couple black kids, you know, yelling back and forth with a bunch of white supremacists, and made for some good photos, and, you know, there's always a chance that something might happen, So I followed along for a while. I kind of lost DeAndre for a moment, and I turn around and see a skirmish ahead of me, and I run towards the garage, and that's when you see the photos that I took that you can, you know, you can see at least one of them at on my Twitter, at ZD Roberts. But you can see a whole bunch more over at nationofchange.org and over at gregpalace.com as well. So.
Right. So you happened to be there and you witnessed the beating of DeAndre Harris. And again, I'll post the article from Nation of Change where you have there's one it's sort of like a time. There's a few photos that it's almost stop action where you see them beating this poor man mercilessly. Now, in the immediate aftermath of the beating, didn't they charge DeAndre Harris with a crime?
So if you go on my Twitter feed, if I post about DeAndre Harris, I can kind of promise you within 15 minutes, one of the, whether it be 4chan or one of the kind of that group of Stormfront loving, you know, white supremacist people will drop on my feed and go, well, what about this video clip? And there's a video clip out there that shows DeAndre Harris, or at least claims to show DeAndre Harris beating beating a white supremacist over the head. So first you have to take, by the way, the idea that DeAndre Harris was later arrested for assault.
Wow.
I think it was assault, for assault against this white guy. And you have to assume first that the idea of white supremacists being on the streets of your hometown isn't something that you have to defend yourself against to begin with. But you also, if you watch the video, you'll notice that DeAndre Harris missed. because what was happening was there was a struggle over a flagpole, and one of the other white supremacists was trying to stab one of DeAndre Harris's friends in the stomach with the end of the flagpole,
as a
good American would. a good Make America Great Again loving flag lover would. So that's the reason why DeAndre Harris was initially charged with assault. The problem was, and go to nationofchange.org and you can read the full story there. I think I might have it over at vsu.news, the news site I run. But it explains the fact that the charges were brought to a magistrate judge in the state of Virginia, which is just basically a lawyer that has like a vague amount of appointed powers that can be basically anybody. And you don't have to actually show evidence to this judge to get charges brought against somebody like you would if you went to the Charlottesville Police Department and said, I would like this person charged with assault. They would say, well, what, do you have video? Do you have any evidence of what happened? What do you have?
Mm-hmm.
He provided nothing other than his own claim that it happened. And so basically that's why it was thrown out, because there was no evidence showing that it happened. Even DeAndre Harris's lawyer was pretty confident from day one that it was going to get thrown out. I wasn't so confident, because I had dealt with the Charlottesville Police Department and the Charlottesville justice system, and I didn't have much faith in the fact that DeAndre wouldn't be railroaded because of, the president's claim of, there being good people and bad people on both sides.
Right.
I thought that maybe he was going to get thrown under the bus for that, because then also that would have allowed the court system there to just go, well, we can give the white supremacists shown in my photos and in, and Chuck Modi's video and everything else, we can just kind of give those guys, misdemeanors and kind of give them, maybe a ticket or some community service and kind of like, just get it out of the way so we don't have to actually deal with it. And we can kind of move on from Charlottesville being known as, well, Charlottesville.
Right, right. But that's not what happened. Actually, there was, I guess, sort of a crowdsourcing effort to identify the people in the photos that you took in the video. And a number of them have been identified. And the first up was actually convicted. Yes?
Yep. We got two now convicted.
Okay.
There is Goodwin and Ramos. Ramos is the the guy in the white shirt, I don't know what other to call it other than kind of the derogatory term, the white shirt he has on, and also he has a red Make America Great hat on while he's beating DeAndre Harris. Oh, yeah. You can go to you'll link the photo in there, and you'll be able to. He's the man I believe that I made the animated GIF out of him taking swings at DeAndre Harris while he was on the ground. That's Ramos. Goodwin is a guy who's kind of harder to see in my photo. He's in the back. He's holding on to a shield. There's four people total that have been arrested. Those two guys, Goodwin and Ramos, were found guilty, and the jury recommended, I think it's 5 and 6 years, respectively, for their crimes. At least one of them is getting like a $10,000 fine as well.
Wow.
And also counseling, which I'm not kidding. They actually recommended like basically sensitivity counseling for these guys, which is kind of amazing. One of them tried to claim self-defense.
Unbelievable.
And he's the guy with the big shield.
Uh-huh.
And the helmet. I'm sorry. Like I laugh at this. It's not funny, but it's so unbelievably ridiculous that they tried so hard to try to claim self-defense on this, when in fact the Goodwin, I believe it was the Goodwin who claimed self-defense, he actually wasn't even at the original scene when the one, you know, where they, because they claimed the beating was because of DeAndre Harris attacked one of their friends, and so it was like that was them doing self-defense while DeAndre Harris was laying in the fetal position and they were kicking him in the head and beating him with metal poles.
Unbelievable.
Like that's the claim of self-defense. Right. But this guy, Goodwin, who with the shield and the helmet, wasn't even physically at the original scene. So he had actually no claim at all whatsoever to anything near a self-defense plea. So, yeah.
We're speaking with a photojournalist, Zach Roberts. You can find him at nationofchange.org. And what is Visu, V-I-S-U.com?
V-I-S-U.news.
Dot
N-E-W-S.
News. Ah, V-I-S-U.news.
Yeah. The visual news site that I'm starting up.
So. Oh, great. Okay. Good to know. And of course, we know your work along with Greg Palast as well. So I mentioned there's sort of a crowdsourcing effort to identify these people, and Sean King, who, I guess made a name for himself on Twitter, then was hired by the New York Daily News, and now is with The Intercept. He's on a tear today, still trying to identify some of these people, because some of them are still have still not been identified, including the guy who held a gun on you. In fact, on YouTube,
it's really perplexing. We've seen him now. Actually, somebody actually found him in my own photos, which is really weird because I didn't see him beforehand. So if you go, you can check the Sean King's Twitter feeds, and then Greg Palast has posted a couple times about it as well, because he's trying to find, you know, obviously the guy who pulled a gun on me. And weirdly, we don't have a name for this guy yet, at least the guy that, you know, pulled a gun on me. And it's perplexing. Sean and I were talking on Twitter a couple days ago, and we were both just like, because the other people came relatively quickly. And, you know, maybe it's just because, like, you know, Ramos has a very distinctive look. Like, if you look at him, he wears the red hat a lot. He has, you know, a certain beard and wear, you know, he has a distinctive, but it's weird that the guy who pulled the gun on me has not been found yet. But I'm so happy that Sean King has been doing this, because it's also, I deeply worry about any time that it goes into the quote unquote citizen journalism, let's find the guy. If we all remember the Boston bomber and how Reddit kind of screwed that up quite well. And Sean has been able to control it really, really well to make sure that it doesn't go wild and that people don't get hurt or people don't get whatever, or, you know, don't get falsely accused. It's amazing. It's like some Minority Report sort of thing going on with, you know, people using all the photos that are available, using video clips that, you know, Chuck Modi took and you know, past ones from previous white supremacist rallies, and like, I have a hard time following it sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, but that's the current one. If you look for Sean King, or if you go to Greg Powell at Greg underscore Palast, his page, he has a bunch of photos on Twitter of the guy who pulled a gun on me. And yeah, we're still looking for that guy and a couple other of the guys that, attacked DeAndre as well.
So how's DeAndre doing now?
Last I heard, he hasn't been really doing that many, reports. I've only kind of like heard, like brief things through his lawyer that I've talked to. And he's healed, as much as you can kind of be healed from that physically, at least. But he had to leave his job, working as a special ed assistant teacher, which is unfortunate. He left because he couldn't handle his serious PTSD issues.
Hmm.
And so he couldn't be kind of in front of a large crowd and he has a problem with being in crowds now.
Right. Understandably.
Not surprisingly, I just witnessed it and I get stressed out at last couple of white supremacist rallies I've covered. Even worse there is that he had to leave the Charlottesville area because he had received so many death threats.
Wow.
Because there's a huge, I received death threats because I covered this. And so I can't even imagine what DeAndre has gotten because, Heather Heyer's mom received horrible things, through social media and through letters and through everything else as well. But, DeAndre's the survivor and they can still go after this poor kid. So I'm hoping he's doing better. He's been testifying at the trials, and based on the reporters that have been in the courtroom, he seems to be all there, which is good, because I can certainly see after something like happening like this in your hometown, especially 30 feet away from the police department,
right?
To not be comfortable in a courtroom. Especially as a young black kid,
right.
He's 21 probably now. He was 20 when I met him, so he's probably 21 now. I don't know, but yeah, I don't know how he's dealing with it. He's a braver kid than I am.
me too. So two of the four men charged in that August 12th assault of DeAndre Harris have been on trial already. Two more are awaiting trial, and they're still waiting to identify some others. Has this turned around your opinion of the Charlottesville law enforcement at all, or were they just forced into it?
Not at all. They actually, one of them actually lied on the stand about offering aid to DeAndre. I have absolutely no opinion of the Charlottesville Police Department. I still have not been interviewed about it.
Unbelievable.
I've talked to DeAndre's lawyer a couple times, and thankfully they didn't need me to testify or anything like that. But I still haven't. I tried, and I forget whether I talked to you before or after this, but again, if you go on nationofchange.org, I wrote about it. I wrote about my attempted conversations with the FBI back when they were potentially going to, look at these attacks as federal hate crimes, which is something they should have been charged at. I think under the Obama administration, they probably would have been, which that's saying something because the Obama administration was never really that amazing on this level
mm-mm.
either.
Mm-mm.
The Charlottesville Police Department, I called them on a Friday after trying to get a hold of them several times, and basically the direct quote that I had was, well, it's a Friday, everybody's trying to finish up for the weekend, would you mind if we had this conversation in a couple days? That was the kind of, I don't think I responded because other than just going, okay, because that's just not something you would ever think about when you talk to a police department. If it was a random assault or something like that you witnessed, if you live in like a big city, I've witnessed a bunch of things and potentially, potentially talked to police officers about what I saw. But like, this was the biggest news story in America for a month.
Right.
Which is saying something during the Trump administration, and they had very little interest in dealing with it.
Amazing.
The FBI took down their they had a website set up that would allow you to upload photos and videos and that sort of thing, which had a limit of 3 photos that you could upload.
Oh, no.
And a max, I think it was 128 megabytes, which if you ever
wow.
look at a file on what you take a photo with an iPhone.
Yeah,
or
it's
on your
bigger
iPhone.
Than that. Right.
And I had, and they had no interest, the FBI had no interest in talking to me other than just to get every single one of my images, which is not something I would ever do in a million years.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't even give every single one of my images to DeAndre Harris's lawyer. It's just not something
right.
journalistically you should
sure.
do. Also, what I assumed was that they were trying to go after, trying to go after the members of, you know, the quote unquote Antifa. I have a lot of photos that could very easily be taken out of context, you know, so. Yeah.
Zach Roberts is with us. And again, we've gone on so long on this. We've only got a few minutes left. And I want to touch on yeah. the NRA convention. You went to your yeah. fourth NRA convention this weekend.
Yep.
Why do you
yep.
do this to yourself?
Because I hate myself. No. Because I love Dallas in May so much. No. actually, Dallas was quite nice. All the Lyft drivers that I took were like, "Why are you doing this?"
Mm-hmm.
it started out as a kind of on a gaffe 4 years ago. I cover one of the very few photojournalists on the left that cover the conservative side of politics. Like
mm-hmm.
I go to CPAC every year.
Ooh.
I go to, you know, I cover white supremacy. I cover
yes.
There's not a lot of photojournalists on the left to begin with, but not a lot of us cover that area because usually we can't get in. We can't get access or whatever. Luckily, I'd been able to just get in every year. I've never had a problem getting credentialed to the NRA. And I cover it because I think it's, you know, I've always said that even before Parkland and before everything, NRA is one of is the most important lobbyist group probably in America.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's bigger than the Koch brothers to me. Like the Koch brothers can be stopped quite easily. The NRA, it seems like they can't be stopped when it comes to, you know, influencing politicians, that sort of thing. You can easily, on the Republican side, you can run against the Koch brothers or ignore the Koch brothers and still win your primary seat. I've yet to really see a Republican that can ignore the NRA and still win their seat. And now you have people like, Brian Kemp, who's running for governor, who's literally doing commercials holding a rifle on, I think it was his daughter's boyfriend.
Right.
And aiming it at him.
Yeah.
And pulling the trigger.
Amazing.
Like, it's unbelievable how low politicians will go to satisfy the bloodlust of the NRA or the gun lust of the NRA, who are nothing more than gun fetishists at this point. They're not gun lovers. They're not Second Amendment people. They're gun fetishists.
Well, you have a new piece up at nationofchange.org today, NRA 2018, The Fear Comes to Dallas, with the subheading, "The convention is no longer just celebration of guns and their accessories, but a fully integrated Donald Trump rally." Do you think Donald Trump has ever even fired a gun?
I don't think he would know how to. I mean, he claims supposedly he has a concealed carry permit in New York,
uh-huh.
which is unbelievably difficult to get, but he's a billionaire, so
well,
at least
so
he's
he
worth
says.
A couple hundred million dollars. He probably could get one if he wanted to. I doubt it. I know his sons have.
Yes.
In 2015, I was there. If you can actually go back on YouTube and search Donald Trump's 2015 speech, when all the primary candidates were talking, everybody from, you know, Marco Rubio to Donald Trump gave little speeches. He actually said, "I'm not really that much of a big gun guy, but my sons are." And he has
mm-hmm.
his sons come out on and talk, you know, and talk about how much they love hunting. And, you know, if we know what the Trump
yes.
sons actually love to hunt, it's not deer or anything like that. It's,
no.
you know,
it's big game.
Slow-moving elephants.
Right.
So.
So did you learn anything new at this year's NRA convention?
The fear is bigger than ever then, bigger than I've ever seen it. The NRA, I've been a member for most of those 4 years.
Really?
I get their magazines. I get their paraphernalia.
Uh-huh.
I get their credit card offers. I get their insurance offers. I have a pile, and I'm actually not kidding, right on my desk right now. I have a pile that's about 4 or 5 inches deep because I've started collecting everything, because I'm actually working on a documentary right now called Good Guys with Guns,
okay,
about the history of the NRA.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and I'm actually working with Jeannie Devon of
Mudflats
and the Blood of Patriots,
yep,
fame. Mm-hmm. So she's going to be my on-camera and my reporter for it.
Awesome.
But what the magazines, you should, if you ever get a chance to, throw them $25 and you'll get a year's worth of the most insane propaganda. I mean, it's unbelievable the fear that it builds. You can see why white, you know, scared, you know, middle-aged white people,
right,
up in their cabins or wherever in their suburban enclaves are terrified of what's happening.
Zach,
this is the news you watch. Yes.
We're out of time. I'm so sorry. Yeah. Thank you so much. I'll post links to all this stuff on my blog at NicoleSandler.com. Thank you so much, Zach Roberts.
Awesome. Have a good one.